Welcome to the GMO Mini Summit, where you can get informed, get inspired, and take action. This is Ocean Robbins, and you are about to hear a special interview conducted by best-selling author, filmmaker, and GMO expert, Jeffrey Smith. Take it away, Jeffrey.
Hi, this is Jeffrey Smith. I'm so excited to be interviewing my good friend Michael Antonio, who I've known for years. Dr. Michael Antonio is he's a hero among those of us who've been trying to understand genetic engineering from the inside, because he is a genetic engineer. He works at a major London university and hospital and the group leader of the Department of Medical and Molecular Genetics. He's got 32 years of experience in genetic engineering technology, and he looks into investigating the organization of genes and how they exert control or control other things. He'll tell us how they work, and he does over 50 peer-reviewed publications, spoken all over the world. But he also has shed light on the myths that have been pushed out by the biotech industry and their claims of safety and their claims of big mass promises. He's the co-author of GMO Myths and Truths, available online at Earth Open Source, as well as a very extensive expose report on GMO, on Roundup and birth defects, on Roundup in general. He also represented the non-governmental organizations in the GM Nation debate back in the late 90s in the UK. So he's been in the game since 1995. And welcome, Michael Antonio.
Pleasure to join you, Jeffrey, on this important broadcast.
Now, Michael, I'd like to hear how you can be a genetic engineer and focusing on gene research, which will be applied to human gene therapy, which has been applied to human gene therapy. You're totally gung-ho in terms of your own work, and yet you're totally the opposite in terms of what the biotech industry is doing for our food. What's the big difference here, and how could you be a genetic engineer not in favor of genetically modified organisms?
I think the way we use genetic engineering for research and clinical application acknowledges the unpredictable side of the technology, the limitations and unpredictable side of the technology, and as a result, part and parcel of these applications are under what we would call a responsible, contained use of these procedures. So in other words, what we do does not result in the release of a living, viable GMO that can replicate and spread into the environment and also enter the food chain and expose, therefore, the vast majority of the population to its consequences. What we do is really contained. It's a biological and a physical containment of the technology, and therefore we are acknowledging in that context that there may be untoward consequences, because the GM technology, however it's applied, is imprecise, and there will always be knock-on effects that you would not be able to predict in advance. And that would include, in a food context, disruptions to plant host gene biochemistry that can give rise to novel toxins, allergens, disturbed nutrition, and so forth.
So when you say it can disturb the plant's own metabolic functions and gene functions, etc., can you explain for us how the technology works and how it might do that? Because a lot of people don't know how you genetic engineer. You do it all the time. So how would you create a GMO, and why would that create potential side effects from a technical standpoint?
Very good question. All the GMOs that are on the market now and in the pipeline are produced, they're laboratory creations where you artificially introduce your foreign GM gene into the plant material growing on dishes in the laboratory. And these foreign GM genes, they insert randomly into the plant cell DNA. And so you have no control over that GM gene insertion process. So this brings one level of uncertainty in the procedure. By not knowing where the GM gene inserts, you don't know what host gene function or functions you will be disturbing as a result. In addition to that, you will be bringing about new combinations of genes. We have to bear in mind that no gene works in isolation. Genes have evolved to work as families, as groups, as whole genomes, as a total whole of gene function. And just changing one gene within that context has a consequences of a wide range of gene functions and therefore on biochemical processes. So when you combine these phenomena, firstly, the disruptive effect of the GM transformation process, and secondly, the novel combinations of genetic material that you're bringing about, this is what introduces a major unpredictable component in the outcome of the plant, the GMO plant that you're producing. You can disturb, you will always, actually I would go as far as to say that you will always disturb plant host biochemistry through this procedure. It's simply a matter of degree rather than if. And
what we're doing is we're throwing a genetic dart, so to speak, into the genome in a random place, not having any idea where it lands. It can disturb a network of genes which could end up, as you say, producing a toxin or increasing a level of an existing toxin or allergen or nutrient problem. Don't they check to see where the gene ends up to see if it has caused a problem before they expose this food to human beings?
On the whole, no, actually, is the short answer to that. Certainly, the kind of analysis which has been done, which has identified GM gene insertion in commercialized crops, has been done post-marketing rather than pre-marketing. So these products have been released onto the market, not only poorly characterized in terms of where the GM gene has spliced in and what disturbances may have occurred, but little or no evaluation of the uncertain consequences, uncertain component to their technology, which is major. I would go as far as to say again that the unpredictable outcomes of GM are greater than what you would predict the GM gene to do for you.
All right, so you've inserted the gene, you've disrupted something, or in some cases many things. It hasn't been looked at. Tell me about the next stage in the creation of a gene, of a transgene, or of a transgenic product. So the insertion itself disturbs. It can also create mutations around its location, and then tell us, take it from there.
Certainly. So there are a number of levels at which plant host gene disruption can take place. First, one we've covered already, which is this random insertion of the foreign gene into the DNA of the plant. This insertion process is not a clean one in most instances, and you will lose bits of the host plant DNA around the site where the GM gene has inserted. In addition to this, the physical process of growing plant material in the laboratory, a process known as tissue culture, which is an integral part of the GM transformation process, that also in itself causes hundreds, if not thousands, of mutations, alterations, damage sites in the plant DNA. And so when you mature a whole plant from a GM transformed plant cell on your dish, you will be carrying through with it all of these mutations, all this DNA damage that you created during the GM transformation process in your laboratory environment.
All right, so let me get this. Let me make it sure that this is clear. So you insert the gene, and typically it's done by a gene gun or by bacterial infection. That can create a localized trauma, messing up certain specific gene families. And then you put the whole thing through tissue culture, a form of cloning, as you told me once, and then that process can cause mutations throughout the DNA, and that process, again, do they check to see which mutations this tissue culture has created, or they just put it on the market?
No, there's no evaluation of mutagenic effects on a molecular level like that by industry or required by regulators actually anywhere in the world. So really, these products have been released onto the market very poorly characterized and not properly evaluated for safety. We have to bear in mind that because of the unpredictable component, unknown component to the GM transformation process, the only logical way of evaluating their safety is generically. That is to say, non-target. There's no point in going around looking for a toxin because you don't know what that toxin is going to look like or be. So the only way you can do it is through empirical, basic investigation. You've got to take the GMO, you've got to feed it to animals in an approved toxicity assay long-term and find out whether those animals do well or whether they fall sick. And if they do fall ill, what types of illnesses they suffer and whether that is of any relevance to humans.
I'd like to get into the animal feeding studies, and I know that you were one of the chief media spokespersons for the Seralini study when it came out. Very, very critical study. But before we get off this gene mutation, I've got a couple of questions. The process of just regular sexual reproduction, doesn't that introduce mutations? And how does the number of mutations through sexual reproduction compare to the number or type of mutations that you get through this GM transformation process?
Natural breeding brings about changes, can bring about changes in many genes that bring about variations on a theme of a pre-existing gene. These are what we call the recombination events that can take place at the time of sexual reproduction. You're not bringing about the types of genome-wide mutations that the GM transformation brings about, and also you're not bringing about the kinds of combinations, novel combinations of genes, because with GM, you're basically, normally, you're introducing genes from totally unrelated sources. You're introducing virus genes or bacterial genes or unrelated plant genes or even animal genes into plants. In other words, combinations of genes that would never occur in a natural breeding program. So although there's natural variation that occurs through sexual reproduction, it's on a different quality and quantity compared to what happens in the GM transformation process. Some of the, in principle, a large number of the mutational effects that the GM transformation process brings about can be bred out through subsequent breeding programs. They can be, in effect, repaired. But it's obvious from research that has been conducted that many of the damaged sites get retained in the final marketed product with disturbances, with measurable disturbances in the biochemical composition of the food product.
Let's talk about one of those research studies. It was a Zola study in Zola's the author, Proteomics is the name of
the journal.
They looked at Monsanto's corn, and this was, again, you said that Monsanto never looked at these things before they were put on the market, and they did what was called a proteomics analysis. Explain to us what proteomics means and what is it that they found. What was different in Monsanto's BT corn besides the BT that was part of this background noise of side effects?
Yes, the Zola study is a very interesting one that really graphically illustrates the damaging effect of the procedure and what regulators clearly missed at the time when they approved it. Basically, a proteomics study is where you look at the protein compositional profile, a very extensive, if not total, certainly much of the protein compositional profile of the organism under investigation. On this occasion, it was Monsanto's MON810 GMBT corn variety.
So when you say MON810, I want to make sure everyone realizes that is the most popular type of BT corn event that Monsanto then hybridizes or crosses into all sorts of types of corn. And when you talk about protein profile, all the genes along the genome, a lot of them, produce proteins, and so we're looking at each of the different proteins, or a lot of them, that are produced by the plant DNA. Okay, I wanted to make sure that was clear. Go ahead.
Yes, that's correct. So what these Italian researchers did was it's an excellent study. They grew the GMO Monate 10 and its genetically equivalent variety. They're like the parent non-GMO parent variety of corn. So in other words, these two, the GMO and the non-GMO in this situation, were supposed to be genetically equivalent, except for that the GMO has this foreign BT gene inserted into it. So they grew the GMO Monate 10 and the non-GMO parent, what's called the isogenic line, side by side in the same field at the same time. So that this is important because this means that any variations in composition caused by differences in environment and climate, including climate and soil conditions, are eliminated. So then, if there are compositional differences between the two, then you know it has to be due to the GM process rather than anything due to environment. And lo and behold, what these Italian scientists found, that they were managing tens of genes whose expression was either higher or lower in the GMO compared to the non-GMO parent. The GMO was also producing truncated proteins. What I mean by that is proteins, incomplete proteins in the seed, in the kernels themselves. And there was even one protein in the GMO called Zain, which wasn't even present in the parent. And this Zain protein is crucial because it's a known allergen. And in addition to this, they found that the GMO and the non-GMO were responding differently to different environments, showing that their gene expression profile, the gene expression response, was altered by the GM transformation event. So these are really dramatic. These are not little differences. These are very dramatic differences, just on the level of the protein compositional profile of this plant, which indicates that other components of the plant as well are also likely to be highly altered by the GM transformation process. With, as I say, because we don't know all of these alterations, the health consequences of the consumption are unknown, which is why you have to evaluate it in a very non-specific, generic way.
I want to drill down into this thing that you just described. First of all, I read the study, and it was interesting. The authors just said, interestingly, that there's now gamazane produced in the corn, which is a known allergen. I mean, it's just to them marked or warranted and interesting that some people mm-hmm. might have anaphylactic shock reactions to corn because a gene which is normally silent in natural corn was switched on accidentally from the gene transformation process. So now they're eating an allergen that's not labeled, that's not identified, that no one knew about, and that people had been eating since Monsanto introduced the corn. That only warranted or elicited an interestingly. But then in the next sentence, it said of major concern was the fact that there was this truncated seed proteins. Now, why mm-hmm. would a truncated seed be a major concern where a new allergen in corn only warrant an interesting?
That's a very good question, actually. I think it has to be, what are the implications? What are these truncated seed proteins telling you? What they're basically telling you is there have been major disruptions to the gene structure of this corn. For me, the only way you can get these truncated proteins is if the genes for them, or the processing of the products of the genes, has been markedly disrupted, disturbed, one way or another. And if that's going on with some, it's likely to be going on with other processes as well. So I think it's the implication of seeing these truncated seeds. What is it telling you as to what the GM transformation process has done? And what it's highlighting is that it's done a lot of damage.
So they're obviously not so clued into the food safety issue if a new allergen is only interesting. From a food safety perspective, what could go wrong when a protein is changed its structure or is truncated, etc.?
Obviously, it can bring about new biochemistry. You have to remember, all the biochemistry of the plant is determined by proteins, especially in the form of enzymes. And if you are creating accidentally, inadvertently truncated proteins, altered structural proteins with different specificities, then you're going to have major changes in the composition, biochemical composition of that plant. And this is where the possibility of creating new allergens particularly can arise, as well as novel toxic substances. Because there will be side biochemical reactions now, perhaps, that were not there before. And small molecules in the plant, enzymatic reactions from on small molecules, we know they can result in toxic substances as well as benign substances.
All right, so in other words, if you change the shape of a protein, something that could be harmless and beneficial can all of a sudden, you know, be Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and come out causing damage to the body. I'm assuming, and I know, that they don't actually check for this stuff before it gets on the market. This whole Zola proteomics study was done after the corn was released. All right, so now that we get an understanding of just how irresponsible, I'm using my words, not putting it in your mouth, irresponsible it is to cause all this massive, as I call it, collateral damage in the DNA, possibly increasing the existing levels of toxins or allergens or introducing new ones, as happened in MON-810 mm-hmm. with the new allergen. So then what kind of tests do they do on animals, and are these competent to discover these type of problems? Can you describe the industry research, which I describe as rigged to avoid finding problems, but I want to hear your description because you know what could go wrong and you know what's needed to evaluate to catch it.
Yes, certainly. This is a very, very crucial point. In the United States, you basically have a deregulated system so that actually Monsanto, in this occasion, because they generated them, if we're talking about 1A10 here, but the other corn and the soy varieties, they claim compositional equivalence between the GMO and the non-GMO, except for the one new GM gene, GMO gene, and this product. They're claiming equivalence between the GMO and the non-GMO, and therefore no need for safety evaluation, and the FDA, USDA accepts that. However, in Europe, we require a little bit more in terms of safety evaluation. And although not strictly required, Monsanto conducted a 90-day feeding study in rats to evaluate toxicity of its GMO corn varieties that they wanted marketing in Europe. This was the MON-810, the MON-863, and the NK603. All three corn varieties are subjected to a 90-day rat feeding study. So in this experiment, you had feeding groups that were fed the GMO, you had feeding groups that were fed the non-GMO equivalent parent, the isogenic, and then in addition, what Monsanto does is also include feeding groups with six other unrelated non-GMO corn varieties. Its conclusion at the end of this feeding study, looking at various blood composition and urine composition and function parameters, was that the GMO was as safe as the non-GMO to consume. Now, this position was accepted by the European regulators, and these corn varieties were approved for marketing, and they entered the European market as well as the American market. However, upon close scrutiny of the raw data from these studies, and the raw data was obtained here in Europe thanks to some court action from NGOs, because it were being kept hidden by confidentiality clauses, the close scrutiny of the raw data actually highlighted up to around 50 different parameters, 50 different physiological and biochemical parameters that were highly statistically significant between the GMO and the non-GMO feeding group. Especially, they appear to reflect signs of toxicity, especially to liver and kidney function. Now, when this was highlighted to the industry and the regulators in Europe, they accepted that there were statistically significant differences in biochemical and physiological function between the GMO and the non-GMO feeding group, but they dismissed them as somehow biologically non-significant. Now, in a scientific circle, I can reassure you that there is no such thing as something being in a biological measurement which is statistically significant and which is not biologically significant. For me, this was almost like trying to rewrite the rules of biological science. It simply doesn't exist. You may not know the biological consequence of a statistically significant measurement, but that doesn't mean you can dismiss it. The only way you can really get to the bottom of it is to, of course, do further studies and see if you can figure out what's going wrong. But unfortunately, because the regulators and industry said that there's no biological significance, there was no requirement of the regulators on the industry to conduct a longer-term study to see whether these differences in biological measurements, especially to liver and kidney function, to see whether these possible signs of liver and kidney damage escalated into something serious in the longer term. Because you have to remember, this was only a 90-day feeding study, which is equivalent to about 8-9 years of human life.
Right. And also, it's only up to 33% of the diet, which is corn. And I know that in South Africa and Southern Africa, they can eat 50 or 70% of their diet as corn. So they're assuming that if a rat can survive with slight or with 50 different statistically significant indicators of change after 90 days and only one-third corn, then it's okay for humans to eat it 50 or 70% corn for a lifetime without looking at the changes in the liver and kidneys there. Okay, so
it's more problematic than that, because actually there were even highly statistically significant readings in some parameters, even the 11% GMO feeding group.
Oh, really? Okay, so they had two different feeding groups, one that ate 11% and one that ate 33%,
and there was
statistical significance in both.
So, yes, this is true. So that's why it fell, in the end, it fell on the shoulders of a responsible, independent academic scientist, Professor Gilles-Éric Seralini, to actually do what industry should have done, which is to extend their 90-day feeding study of one of their corn varieties, the Roundup-tolerant NK603 variety, extend that study beyond 90 days to see whether the signs of toxicity did escalate or whether they simply fizzled out and didn't amount to anything. And so what we have here in Professor Seralini's study is a very, very important to appreciate that it's simply, on one level, a direct follow-on investigation of the Monsanto study. He used basically the same experimental design, the same strain of rats measured, but he did two things that were different. Firstly, he expanded the range of parameters that he measured, but importantly, he increased the duration of the experiment to 2 years rather than 90 days, which is almost the entire lifespan of the rat. And finally, he broke down the test feeding groups. He did more test groups than anybody else. He not only fed the GMO, but he fed the GMO with and without Roundup spray, and he also fed Roundup alone at very low doses. The idea here being that if you do see a negative health outcome, you can distinguish whether it's the GMO alone that's causing it, and therefore something to do with the GM process, or whether it's the Roundup or a combination of the two.
So this is actually brilliant. I mean, we saw a similar kind of isolation of the cause in Pustai's study from 96, and 98. So they tested a Roundup alone, a Roundup Ready Corn alone, and Roundup Ready Corn sprayed with Roundup as it's normally fed to humans. This is an epic setup, Michael. This is perfect. It's like, is the emperor wearing no clothes? Is the assumption that the entire regulatory framework around the world is based on that a 90-day rat study or mice study is going to be sufficient to tell us if this stuff is dangerous? And Cerellini calls their bluff, extends the 90-day thing, does more. Okay, we've set up the thing. Tell us what he found. Absolutely epic.
No, what you're saying is absolutely right. They are trying to tell us that you can base whole lifelong consumption exposure to these GMOs based on a 90-day feeding study in rats. That is so unscientific, it's not even worth mentioning in the same breath or sentence. But basically, what Professor Cerellini's study found, and it is a landmark investigation, first of all, the primary objective of the study was confirmed in that the signs of liver and kidney damage that were seen at 90 days in the Monsanto study did, in fact, escalate into very serious damage, especially in the male animals, because there were female groups and male feeding groups. But especially in the male feeding group, they were dying prematurely from liver and kidney failure. This is something that peaked during the second year of the life of the animals. So that, in a way, proved the primary objective of the investigation. In addition to that, however, there were two highly significant, surprising findings. The first one was that even Roundup alone, there were a number of important findings. One of the other starting hypotheses of this study for Professor Cerellini was that actually any negative health outcome was going to be due to the Roundup. He was not actually expecting any negative health outcome from just feeding the GMO alone without any Roundup application during its cultivation. But actually, he found that the GMO alone, without any Roundup application, was also causing these negative health outcomes, both in terms of liver and kidney damage, but also, quite unexpectedly, in terms of escalating higher tumor incidence. Many of the test groups at the different doses of Roundup and of the GMO corn, either with or without the Roundup, it doesn't matter, were causing an increase in the tumor incidence, especially in the females, with respect to mammary tumors, breast tumors. And this was totally surprising to the investigators, but nevertheless, very real. Especially in some of the female feeding groups, exposed to the Roundup alone at very low doses. Exposure to Roundup at doses that you would find in contaminated drinking water were showing an increase in toxicity and tumor incidence that was 3 to 4-fold higher than the control group. These are glaring, glaring differences that need to be followed up with great urgency to get to the bottom of what is going on.
What you're saying, Michael, is that the amount of Roundup that may be in the U.S. water supply, because as you know, the U.S. Geological Survey did a test and found the Roundup was in 60 to 100% of the air samples and the rain samples in the Midwest, as well as the surface water. It's found in drinking water at certain levels. So you're saying even the drinking water levels of Roundup that's allowable in the United States, when exposed to these rats, they developed massive tumors and also a liver and kidney damage and early death. As well as those fed the Roundup Ready corn, whether or not it was sprayed with Roundup.
Yeah, it's staggering. The level of Roundup that was found to be toxic was half the dose that is presumed perfectly safe in Europe, and I believe something like, it's 20 times lower than what's permitted in American water. contaminated.
Wow. Well, we Americans are obviously more robust than the Europeans, so we can take more Roundup than you guys. Is that it?
maybe. You said it, not me.
I said it. But all right, so we have these rats. Now, weren't there also changes in the hormonal system?
Yes, there were. There were disturbances to sex hormone systems in both the males and the females, testosterone in the males and estrogen in the females. There were clearly these feeds, these different test feeds, whether it was Roundup or GMO or GMO plus Roundup, seemed to have what we would call an endocrine disruptive effect. They were disturbing crucial hormonal control systems in the bodies of these animals. And again, just crucially, an important point to bear in mind, all of these negative health outcomes were peaking during the second year of life of these animals. They began to increase during the first year, but they were peaking during the second year in life. This is important because, in other words, it's way long after any 90-day feeding study that is currently required by any regulator, and that regulator at the moment is only the European Union.
Didn't the first tumor appear like within 30 days after the 90-day mark?
The first tumor appeared actually at 4 months in males.
Okay,
and at seven
the fourth
months.
Month, right. It's so conveniently.
Yes, in the male and the seventh month in the females.
So conveniently, right after Monsanto would have closed up shop and said, these rats are fine. If they had kept it up, one of the rats and the males may have gotten the tumor, and they said, oh, these rats aren't fine. That's highly convenient there.
it is possible, but as I say, this study needs to be repeated with larger numbers of animals to really get a clear trend, especially in terms of tumor incidence from these feeds. But as things stand, they are highly indicative of something seriously wrong happening. And it would be negligent of any regulator to ignore these findings and dismiss them as somehow flawed. Because if they do, they have to admit that what industry did in the past was also flawed. Professor Cerullini used exactly the same experimental design as Monsanto, only extending it and broadening it, which means that if his study design was wrong, then surely Monsanto's study design was wrong. Actually, both were fine. I think as far as Monsanto did, up to 90 days, was fine. Their mistake was they didn't go longer.
You were there on the cutting edge. You were like right in the eye of the storm here when this hit on September 19th, 2012. I read quotes from you. Tell us, this is a really interesting thing. So far we've shown the process creates side effects that are not evaluated. You have to evaluate them with animal feeding studies. The industry uses animal feeding studies that are incompetent. We finally come along with an independent study that actually shows that a long-term study is causing massive damage to the rats, early death, organ damage, and massive multiple tumors. And what is the result of the scientific community, the press, and the regulators to this epic study?
It was quite staggering. Within a couple of hours of the study going public for scrutiny, it was being dismissed as the experimental design being flawed and that the outcomes were meaningless. It was being criticized as using the wrong strain of rat, not using or analyzing enough rats, when in fact Professor Cerullini he analyzed the same number of animals as Monsanto. He measured all the parameters that Monsanto did, only added to them and increased the duration of the study. I found the criticisms that were levied against this study were scientifically, simply technically unfounded, and as a result, it was actually possible to provide a detailed evidence-based reference rebuttal of all of their criticisms that showed them to be totally and utterly inadequate. Not that the Cerullini study is perfect, no study is perfect, but certainly the criticisms levied against it were unfounded based upon the historical background that led to it and the outcomes that were measured were clearly very significant. The point is that the kidney and liver damage parameters were highly statistically significant between the control and the test groups. even if there weren't enough animals for the study to constitute a proper carcinogenicity study, nevertheless, it was certainly sufficient for a toxicity study. And the study showed marked toxic effects escalating, especially through the second year of life, pertaining especially to liver and kidney function. The reason why it didn't have enough animals for a carcinogenicity study was it was never designed in the first place to be a carcinogenicity study. The increase in the tumors that arose were completely surprising, but in accordance with international regulations, when you do see tumors unexpectedly in a toxicity study, the onus is on the researchers to let the study continue and monitor the outcomes. And that's exactly what Professor Cirillini did, and presents the raw data of those observations in his publication for all to see and make what they want of. Not to dismiss, they're certainly not dismissible, but to take it and follow it up.
Now, I like to say that the biotech industry has millions and billions of dollars to spend, and we who are trying to expose the truth have $1.95. So I know that there was a hugely lopsided debate here when the Cirillini study came out. Tell us the upshot of what actually happened once the other side unleashed all of their guns all over the world. The talking points echoing from one continent to another from the usual suspects. But now I'm starting to answer the questions. So why don't you tell us?
Well, unfortunately, what happened was that a number of statements from academic scientists, but the vast majority of which were found exposed to have links with the industry and therefore had a clear conflict of interest, dismissed the study as structurally flawed in its experimental design, using the wrong animals, cancer-prone animals, not enough animals, wrong statistical analysis, and so forth. And unfortunately, the media picked up on this, and in the UK at least, we effectively had a media blackout on the study. Despite numerous interviews that I gave and others gave, that hardly anything actually appeared in the mainstream media here, and the same in the United States. Although the industry, there have been some exchanges in the scientific literature. Monsanto, for example, published a rebuttal of the study in the journal where the paper appeared. But Professor Cirillini published his response to those criticisms, because really any criticism that levied at Professor Cirillini's study, Monsanto would really have to levy at itself, because it used the same experimental design. So you can't just single out somebody else without pointing the finger at yourself here, in my opinion. This study is very telling, and there's only one way of getting to the bottom of this, and that is to build on it further, to expand it, make it larger, and not only with this variety of GMO. What this study is telling us is that clearly 90-day feeding studies in animals for long-term toxicity evaluation are totally and utterly useless. Literally, I use that word carefully, useless. And that unless you do a two-year toxicity study, carcinogenicity study, you're not going to find out anything about either the GMO or the herbicide or pesticide formulation, in this case Roundup, with which it is intimately used. The toxicity evaluation of pesticides are conducted essentially only on the so-called active ingredient, in this case glyphosate. What Professor Cirillini did, which nobody in the past done and which no regulator has ever demanded anywhere in the world, is to evaluate long-term the complete agricultural formulation of glyphosate, in other words, Roundup. And you have to remember that the agricultural formulations are not just glyphosate. They're complex mixtures of glyphosate plus several defined and undefined adjuvants that are there to boost the effect of the active ingredient herbicide. And what's turning out from studies is that actually some of these so-called benign adjuvants are turning out to be more toxic than the active ingredient. And we feel that this is why because Professor Cerullini gave the full Roundup formulation to his rats, and bearing in mind that they were at incredibly low concentrations, 0.1 parts per billion dilution of Roundup formulation was still highly toxic to these animals, especially the females. And that's because it's full formulation, it's not just glyphosate. And what that's telling you is, got to test the GMO long term, you've got to test the complete pesticide formulation long term as well, if you're really going to get an indication as to the true potential hazards and toxicity of these products.
So I wanted to end this cycle from the transformation process to the animal feeding studies to the Cerullini study by highlighting the regulatory response. I want to hear what happened in Europe with the European Food Safety Authority. I can tell you from the Environmental Protection Agency, which oversees the Roundup residue allowable levels, they just increased the allowable levels of Roundup on fruits and vegetables by as much as 30-fold to many, many parts per million. And you said that this toxic effect came at one part per billion. So they are obviously not paying any attention to what Cerullini did. And I just want to add one editorial note here. I describe the technical term for just looking at the active ingredient and not all of Roundup is what I consider to be enormously stupid. It's like we you know, chemistry has evolved to understand the synergistic effect of toxicity. And it's evolved to understand the endocrine disruption at small levels, which they also ignore. It's completely 50 years behind. This is our U.S. regulators at work. I think the FDA, I don't even know if they made any comment about the Cerullini study whatsoever. They tend to be closed-lipped about everything. Tell what happened in Europe with the European Food Safety Authority and the regulators there.
I think a common mistake made by people, scientists, industry, and regulators, they misinterpreted the Cerullini study up front straight away as a carcinogenicity study. No, this was not a carcinogenicity study. It was a toxicity study that quite unexpectedly showed an increase in tumor incidence. So what the regulators in Europe did was basically really echo the position of the industry, that this study was flawed, it did not have enough animals for a carcinogenicity study, and it was therefore flawed in its experimental design. It used the wrong strain of rat, it didn't use enough animals, and they used the wrong statistical analysis, and so forth. These are the main things that were flagged up as making the study meaningless, really not worth changing anything. But actually, having said that, the European regulators, in a way, I feel I've done a bit of a U-turn. Earlier, just recently, a few months ago, both the European Commission put out a call for applications for a 3 million euro budget to conduct a 2-year carcinogenicity study with this variety of NK603 GMO corn. And in addition, the French regulators, the French authorities, have put up a call for applications for a toxicity study up to the value of 2.5 million euro. And in most recently, the European Food Safety Authority has published its own guidelines on how to conduct a 2-year toxicity carcinogenicity study for a GMO. And if you look at the parameters, the measurements of what they recommend, lo and behold, they reflect mostly the design of Professor Cerullini's study. So in many ways, we feel this is vindication, surely, of Professor Cerullini's experimental design when we have our European Food Safety Authority basically expounding the same experimental design as what Professor Cerullini did. So from initial dismissal of the study, in a way, there's a kind of been a face-saving, in a way, turnaround in what the European regulators are doing in terms of following it up.
It is so interesting. I mean, like, if they had acknowledged the Seralini study right away as being accurate, it would have been a way of saying that everything they had done up to that point was wrong. The testing of the active ingredient only, the allowance of 90-day studies, the declaration that GMOs were safe. So, you know, this was a way of covering themselves, I think. Well, and also, you know, in the United States, we have the revolving door between the regulators and the people who work in the industry, and I understand that a lot of the people who are in the European Food Safety Authority are also part of an association to promote GMOs in Europe. So we have a similar criticism there. I think we have seen the arc here. We've seen the arc from the process of genetic engineering, what can go wrong, how the industry hides the evidence or ignores biologically significant results. When an independent study comes along, it shows that there's massive changes in rats that eat it, or before that, massive changes in the corn as a result of the GM transformation process that might have resulted in the Seralini results. And then finally the response by the industry and the kind of half response by the regulators. Anything you want to say before we go in terms of this whole thing? You've been really in the thick of it. You have been fighting the fight with real scientific understanding about genetic engineering, seeing what the other sides have been doing to independent studies. Is there any, you know, give us the commentary from 50,000 feet about what's going on in this whole arena?
Well, as a molecular geneticist, looking in on GM technology as applied in agriculture, from the perspective of the new genetics, the modern genetics, the complexities of the modern genetics as we're beginning to understand it, is that it's clear that GMOs are both technically and conceptually flawed entities. And what we've basically seen is a technology that was invented in the early 80s hasn't really moved along with the times, with our advances in the basic science. Because when you view it from that perspective, this technology, it's really very, very crude, and it's always going to create problems. It's as simple as that, either to the biochemistry of the plant or the manner in which these crops are being used in agriculture from an agronomy perspective, but that's another issue altogether. So my feeling is that GMOs are yesterday's technology. You know, they don't bear consideration in a modern genetics context. What the modern genetics tells us is that we need to view biology as systems, as integrated wholes, and that any manipulation we want to do needs to preserve that holistic integrity of the organism. Because it is so complex, there is no way that we can manipulate it on a small scale without having untoward side effects, which is why I feel we need to be moving towards a genomics approach to plant breeding, which is already going on very successfully, where we are able to use non-GMO biotechnology tools of gene mapping to speed up our natural breeding programs to produce the kinds of crops that we need in the future in different contexts. Because by doing natural breeding, we are able to introduce desirable traits such as drought tolerance, salinity tolerance, heat stress tolerance, flood tolerance, better nutrition, higher yield. All these traits I've just met, desirable traits I've just mentioned, are complex traits, multi-gene family functions at their basis. GMOs cannot deliver these complex traits because they could only crudely introduce into a plant one or two genes at a time, a few genes at a time, and then in a totally uncontrolled manner. With natural breeding, we can move desired gene families from one crop variety to another, get the gene combinations we want in a very efficacious, expeditious way with augmented plant breeding, which is known as marker-assisted selection, gene marker-assisted selection, and get to where we want to in a far cheaper and quicker way on something that GMOs simply cannot deliver on. And this is, of course, in addition to the fact that I feel we have, over the years, when I first got involved in the public debate on GMOs and looked at it from the level of the genetics as it was then, in a theoretical way, we were saying how things could go wrong in terms of disruption of gene structure and function and knock-on on biochemistry and so on and so forth and possible toxin production. That was all hypothetical because back in the mid-90s, because there hadn't been any experimental work to show whether it was the case or not. What's happened in the intervening years is that the fears we had at the beginning have materialized, both in terms of health and environmental impact. And so it's time that we dropped GMOs, get rid of them out of the system for the health of people and the environment, and got back to natural agroecological farming practices with new and, where necessary, new crop varieties produced through natural breeding programs augmented with modern non-GMO biotechnology tools. That is the direction. That's what we, for me, this is what we should be doing. And if we do that, over above everything else, we will be true to the science. At the moment, continuing with GMOs in agriculture as we are simply not being true to the science. And for me, that is, obviously as a scientist particularly, that is paramount, and that is what we need to be doing. Be true to the science, because at the moment, that is certainly not what the industry and the regulators are doing in promoting governments, regulators, and industry. They're not being true to the science by continuing this line of development.
Thank you. Dr. Michael Antonio, we've been talking to a genetic engineer about GMOs, and it has been so enlightening. It's amazing to hear it from someone who does genetic engineering day in and day out, who's published papers and has been looking at what is actually going on in GMOs and can break it down for us in such a simple, powerful way. We appreciate you, Michael, for your pioneering attitude of willing to talk about this for so long and to continue to deal with those who would rather not focus on the truth, who would like to cover up these dangers and pretend that everything is safe. Thank you for being a voice for all of us in raising it in the media, raising it in the scientific circles, etc. I know I've relied upon you for clarification. So many others have as well. We want to thank you, our listeners, for joining us for this absolutely enlightening interview. Thank you for your time, for your concern, and thank you for taking action. Safe eating.
Best to you all.